Chapter 9. 10,000 years ago, the sand-dry wadis of the Republic of Mali ran full to their banks with water, while the barren flatlands were blanketed with forests filled with hundreds of varieties of plant life. The fertile plains and mountains were home to early man long before he rose out of the Stone Age and became a pastoral herdsman. For the next 7,000 years, vast tribes hunted antelopes, elephants, and buffaloes as they herded their long-horned cattle from one grazing ground to another. In time, overgrazing along with the decreasing rains caused the Sahara to dry out and become the barren desert it is today, ever expanding, ever creeping into the lusher, more tropical lands of the African continent. The great tribes gradually abandoned the region, leaving behind a desolate and nearly waterless area to the few nomadic bands who have lingered on. By discovering the incredible endurance of the camel, the Romans were the first to conquer the desert wastes, utilizing the beast to carry slaves, gold, ivory, and many thousands of wild animals for shipment to the bloody arenas of Rome. For 8 centuries their caravans plodded across the nothingness from the Mediterranean to the banks of the Niger. And when the glory of Rome faded, it was the camel that opened the Sahara frontier to the invading light-skinned Berbers, who were followed by the Arabs and the Moors. Mali represents the end of a line of powerful and long-vanished empires to rule Black Africa. In the early Middle Ages, the Kingdom of Ghana expanded the great caravan routes between the Niger River, Algeria, and Morocco. In 1240 AD, Ghana was destroyed by the Mandingos to the south, who emerged as an even greater empire called Malinke, the basis of the name Mali. Great prosperity was achieved, and the cities of Gao and Timbuktu became widely respected as the centers of Islamic learning and culture. Legends were spun of the incredible wealth carried by the gold caravans, and the empire's fame spread through the Middle East. But 200 years later, the empire had spiraled into decay as the Tuareg and Fulani nomads encroached from the north. The Songhai people to the east gradually took control and ruled until the Moroccan sultans pushed their armies to the Niger and devastated the kingdom in 1591. By the time the French launched their colonial flow southward in the early 19th century, the old empires of Mali were all but forgotten. After the turn of the century, the French established the territories of West Africa into what became known as the French Sudan. In 1960, Mali declared its independence, drew up a constitution, and formed a government. The nation's first president was removed by a group of army officers led by Lieutenant Moussa Traoré. In 1992, after a number of unsuccessful coup attempts, President, now General Traoré, was overthrown by then-Major Zateb Kazim. Soon realizing he could not obtain foreign aid or loans as a military dictator, Kazim stepped down and installed the current President Tahir as a figurehead. A cunning manipulator, Kazim stacked the legislature with his cronies and kept his distance from the Soviet Union and the United States while maintaining close relations with France. He soon set himself up as overseer of all trade, domestic and foreign, enriching a number of his secret bank accounts throughout the world. He dipped into development projects, and despite installing strict customs controls, profited handsomely on the side from smuggling activities. French business payoffs for his cooperation, such as his association with Yves Massard, made him a multimillionaire. Thanks to Kazim's absolute corruption and the greed of his officials, it was little wonder that Mali was one of the world's poorest nations. The UN Boeing 737 banked so close to the ground, Eva thought its wingtip would cut a groove through the mud and timber houses. Then the pilot leveled out on his approach to the primitive airport at the fabled city of Timbuktu and touched down with a firm thump. Gazing out her window, Eva found it difficult to imagine that the grubby town was once the great caravan market of the empires of Ghana, Malinke, and Songhai, and was inhabited by 100,000 people. Founded by Tuareg nomads as a seasonal camp in 1100 AD, it became one of the largest trading centers in West Africa. She found it difficult to envision a glorious past. But for 3 of the ancient mosques still standing, there were few sights of past grandeur. The town looked dead and abandoned, its narrow and crooked streets twisting around and seemingly going nowhere in particular. Its grip on life appeared tenuous and fruitless. Hopper wasted no time. He was out the cabin door and on the ground before the whine of the jet engines died away. An officer, wearing the brief indigo headdress of Kazim's personal guard, walked up to him and saluted. He greeted the UN field researcher in English with a marked French accent. "Dr. Hopper, I presume?" "And you must be Mr. Stanley," Hopper replied with his usual cutting humor. There was no answering smile. The Malian officer gave Hopper an unfriendly look that was obviously coated with harbored suspicions. "I am Captain Mohammed Batuta. You will please accompany me to the airport terminal." Hopper stared at the terminal. It was little more than a metal shed with windows. "Oh, very well, if that's the best you can do," he said dryly, refusing to kowtow. They walked straight to the terminal and into a small, oven-hot office that was bare except for a shabby wooden table and two chairs. Behind the table, an officer, who was senior to Batuta and looked like he was going through a very unhappy phase, sat and studied Hopper for a moment with undisguised contempt. "I am Colonel Nuhum Mansa. May I see your passport, please?" Hopper had come prepared and handed over the six passports he'd collected from his team. Mansa flipped through the pages without interest, noting only the nationalities. Finally, he asked, "Why did you come to Mali?" Hopper had traveled the world and had little use for ridiculous formality. "I believe you know the purpose of our visit." "You will answer the question. We are members of the United Nations World Health Organization on a mission to study reports of toxic illness among your people." "There is no such illness among my people," the colonel said firmly. "Then you won't mind if we analyze water supplies and take air samples in a random selection of the towns and cities along the Niger." "We do not take kindly to foreigners seeking out deficiencies in our country." Hopper was not about to back down in the face of stupid authority. "We're here to save lives. I thought General Kazim understood that." Mansa tensed. The fact that Hopper threw out Kazim's name instead of President Tahir caught him off guard. "General Kazim, he's given orders authorizing your visit. Why don't you ring him up and find out?" It was a bluff, but Hopper had nothing to lose. Colonel Mansa rose and walked to the door. "Wait here," he ordered brusquely. "Please tell the general," said Hopper, "that his neighboring countries have invited United Nations scientists to help them locate the source of contamination. And if he refuses my team's entry into Mali, he will be scorned and lose face among the nations of the world." Mansa made no reply and left the stifling room. While he waited, Hopper gave Captain Batuta his best intimidating stare. Batuta locked eyes for a few moments, but then turned away and began pacing the room. After about 5 minutes, Mansa returned and sat down at the desk. Without a word, he precisely stamped each passport and then passed them to Hopper. "You have been allowed to enter Mali to conduct your research. But please remember, Doctor, you and your people are guests here. No more. If you make unkind statements or take part in any action detrimental to security, you will be deported." "Thank you, Colonel. And please thank General Kazim for his kind permission." "You will be accompanied by Captain Batuta and 10 of his men for your protection." "I'm honored to have a bodyguard." "You will also report your findings directly to me. I expect your full cooperation in this matter." "How will I report from the hinterland?" "The captain's unit will carry the necessary communications equipment." "We should get along handsomely," Hopper said loftily to Batuta. He turned back to Mansa. "My team and I will need a car, preferably a four-wheel drive, for personnel, and two lorries to transport our laboratory gear." Colonel Mansa's face reddened. "I will arrange for military vehicles." Hopper was well aware that it was important for the colonel to save face and have the last word. "Thank you, Colonel Mansa. You are a generous and honorable man. General Kazim must be very proud to have a true warrior of the desert at his side." Mansa leaned back, a growing look of triumph and satisfaction in his eyes. "Yes, the general has often expressed gratitude for my loyalty and service." The interview was over, and Hopper returned to the aircraft and directed the unloading of the cargo. Mansa watched from the window of the terminal office, a faint smile on his lips. Shall I restrict their investigation to unclassified areas? Asked Batuta. Mansa slowly shook his head without turning. No, allow them to go wherever they wish. And if Dr. Hopper finds signs of toxic sickness? No matter. As long as I control communications with the outside world, his reports will be altered to show our country to be clean of illness and hazardous wastes. But when they return to the UN headquarters, won't the true findings be exposed? Mansa finished. Yes, most certainly. He swung around suddenly, his expression menacing. But not if their aircraft tragically meets with an accident during the return flight.